Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Demonic possession and exorcism may seem medieval, marginal, way off your grid. But they're still right there in our language. I'm facing my demons. She's exorcising the past. He's running around like a man possessed. Well, people really did those things and still do, maybe particularly in times of change and challenge. What can we learn from this wild thread of human behavior this hour on Point? The long story still unfolding of possession and exorcism. You can join us on air or online. Is this just the movies to you, The Exorcist? What's this realm about where the devil made us do it? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. This conversation never ends. With me from Austin, Texas is Brian Levack, professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, a scholarly expert in witches and witch hunts. He's now turned his considerable firepower on this related realm. His new book is The Devil Within, Possession and Exorcism in the Christian West. Brian Levack, thank you very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I guess it's a short bridge, perhaps, from studying the history of witches in Western culture to studying possession and exorcism.
Yes, the phenomena are related in that many witches were accused of actually commanding the devil to enter into the human beings who we describe as demoniacs who were possessed, and they were prosecuted for that. The demoniacs, however, were not responsible for what they did. You just mentioned the devil made me do it.
Right.
So we learn about this phenomenon through some witchcraft cases, some witchcraft prosecutions in which the witches are accused of doing this. But we also learn about it through reading various narratives that were published during the 16th and 17th century, which account for the possession and the efforts to exorcise these victims of demonic assault.
I want to look at exactly what you mean when you say possession and exactly what you mean when you say exorcism. But can we just stand back for a moment and note, you point out 16th, 17th century. I mean, this is the early modern period, not the medieval period, where which you and others have called the golden age of, I guess, possession and exorcism. Interesting to me that at the same time that you see science beginning to come onto the scene, sort of the very dawn of the age of reason, you've got this surge in this kind of activity. And then again, you write that the second period in the history of Christianity, quoting you here, that has witnessed a surge in the number of possessions is that of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. That's our time. Why these two times, do you think, Brian?
Well, I think the reason that you have so many possessions in the 16th and 17th centuries is that this was the period of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. And during this period, there was a heightened fear of the devil. There was also a heightened expectation that the world was coming to an end, that we were in the last days. And it was certainly in Scripture, especially in the book of Revelation, that the devil would be exceptionally active during that period preceding the second coming. So there was all this apocalyptic and eschatological anticipation of the devil. And therefore, when people acted strangely, they were suspected of having been demonically possessed.
Do you think it's that fear of the apocalypse or anticipation of it or simply of change, Reformation and Counter-Reformation? That's a lot of challenge and change going on.
Yes, it is. I mean, obviously, these possessions also occurred during periods of tremendous religious change, political change, social change, and that created all sorts of anxieties in society. And people looked for an explanation of this in demonic activity. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please, because I want to go back and really learn about that great age of possession and exorcism. But when you assert here that another peak or surge in this has been the late 20th and early 21st century, I can imagine some people scratching their heads and saying, what is he talking about? You know, possession and exorcism don't show up on my bus ride to work or in my life. What are you talking about when you say a surge again, essentially now?
Yes, there is a demand for exorcism, which I think is at the root of this. It's also that demand, I think, is also stimulated by a considerable number of films and shows that focus on demonic possession.
But where is this demand? I don't run across it in my daily life, I must say, and I'm guessing a lot
either.
Of listeners don't. So if there's a surge, where is it?
I mean, it's in communities, especially in highly religious communities, especially evangelical and charismatic religious communities who believe in a direct relationship between demonic spirits and human beings, and some of those – and spirits and human beings, and I think with good spirits, but also there is the belief in demonic spirits actually interacting with human beings. And whenever you have that belief, and that is a belief that is that has been cultivated greatly in the late 20th century, you're going to get cases of demonic possession. And then you have the demand for exorcists to relieve people of these symptoms of demonic possession. You also have a number of exorcists, especially in Italy and in Latin America and in Poland, far fewer in America. And that might help to explain why we're not familiar with this. I don't meet demoniacs every day. And you have these exorcists who actually go out and drum up business. They're celebrity exorcists. There's one in Italy who claims to have exorcised 70,000 people.
that is one busy
obviously
exorcist.
These people.
Italy, Latin America, Poland, and of course, Hollywood. 1973, The Exorcist. Here's the mother, played Ellen Burstyn, ushers in two doctors, hoping to relieve her thrashing daughter, played by Linda Blair. But the daughter is possessed, and you can hear her voice change in the course of this into that of a growling man, The Exorcist.
Mother, please! Oh, please, Mother,
what's happening?
Stop! It's burning! It's burning!
Do something, Doctor, please help her!
Keep away! The saw is mine!
The Exorcist sounds like a chainsaw there. There's the Hollywood version. We'll talk about that. But Brian, take us back. You're our scholar. What's possession as you look at it? What is exorcism?
Well, possession is unusual, abnormal, you might say pathological behavior that was based on the belief that the devil, and that by that, by him, or we mean Satan, or one or more of Satan's subordinate demons, Beelzebub and Leviathan, okay. And then there are hundreds of little thousands of other subordinate demons. It's the belief that they entered into the body of a person and took control of that person's physical movements and mental faculties. And these demonically possessed people, and we just call them demoniacs, were reported to have displayed a wide variety of physical and psychological symptoms. The physical symptoms almost always included some kind of convulsions or fits. Their bodies swelled in various places. Their limbs became rigid so that it was difficult, if not impossible, to uncross their legs, let us say. They vomited various objects, sometimes nails and pins. And some of them, and this brings us to Linda Blair, because there was that levitation scene, few of them, but every once in a while it was reported that they levitated. They rose into the air.
Maybe they were just thrashing so hard.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, a lot of the reports that I read, a lot of the narratives exaggerate the symptoms of possession. But nevertheless, something was happening. Something unusual was happening.
And similar things, whether it's the 16th, 17th century or the 20th, 21st?
Well, I mean, I think that you don't have that many cases of these classic cases of possession in the modern period. Very often, these are people who have minor medical problems or minor psychological problems, and an exorcist will seek them out, or they will seek an exorcist to relieve them of that. You don't have the cases, the hundreds, perhaps thousands of cases of classic possession which involve these symptoms. And I should say that in addition to these physical symptoms, there were what we would call psychological symptoms. These people were reported to have spoken in languages which they had no previous knowledge of. They spoke in deep masculine voices, and that was especially unusual if they were a sweet young girl.
Which they often had revulsion.
Indeed, most of them were women, and usually young women. I mean, you have some men and you have some older women, but also they had a revulsion of sacred objects because the devil was responsible for what they were doing. And, you know, they said they blasphemed. Some of them
knock over the candlesticks, throw the Bible across the room.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, yes. And you know, and they use the Holy Eucharist, they use communion wafer to exorcise them, to drive the demons out. And they would very often spit on it or trample on it. They would blaspheme. They also went into trances, and they could foresee the future. So you have these two different types of symptoms. And in these classic cases...
Brian Levack, if you'd hold it right there, we'll come back to it.
Yes, that's fine. Okay,
there's
great.
Your possession. We'll look at it then and now. We'll come back and look at what exorcism entailed then and now. And what's going on here, a reenactment in many cases, theatrical reenactment, Brian Levack says. His book is The Devil Within, Possession and Exorcism in the Christian West, theme from The Exorcist behind us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the long and revealing story of exorcism, possession and exorcism, the origins, the history, the method, and madness. My guest is Brian Levack at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is The Devil Within, Possession and Exorcism in the Christian West. Many representations of it in Hollywood from the early 70s until just last year. Here's a bit from the trailer for the 2012 film The Devil Inside. Daughter Isabella, played by Fernanda Andrade, seeks help for her mother who killed three people and is possessed. A priest tries to help.
This is a combination of science and religion based on my background in medicine.
Let's begin.
Isabella.
She said my name.
I found four voices on the recordings.
What does that mean?
Multiple demonic possession.
Please help my mother.
This isn't consistent with any form of possession that I've ever seen. I'm sorry, Isabella.
The great ages of possession and exorcism, says my guest Brian Levack, 16th and 17th centuries, time of Reformation and Counter-Reformation, the dawn of the Age of Reason, interestingly, Sir Isaac Newton's time and more, and late 20th and early 21st century, our time. Maybe not in your neighborhood, but it's out there. Brian Levack is with us from Austin, Texas, and I want to get into what goes on with the exorcism. But let me get a few calls here first. Melissa, Natick, Massachusetts. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When I was 17, the summer of 1987, I went to Greek camp, Greek Orthodox camp in Greece.
Okay.
And they took us to many churches and monasteries, and we were looking at relics, holy relics, and there was a church, and the door was open, and myself and a couple of other campers peeked in because we heard some strange noises from inside the church.
Okay.
I'll never forget what I saw. It was an elderly woman, maybe 50s, 60s for me at the time, but it was elderly, and she was on all fours by the altar. A priest was reading from the Bible. His hands were on her back, and he was trembling as he was reading from the Bible. And she was speaking in a very low, almost Darth Vader mechanical voice. And I understand Greek. It was not Greek. It was not English.
Okay.
It was... I can just imagine what people say speaking in tongues. It was very...
What was the priest doing, Melissa? What was the priest up to there?
He was holding her back, and she brayed like a donkey. He put holy water... He sprinkled holy water on her. She screamed as if she had been scalded and reared up. And at that point, the camp counselors grabbed us and ushered us away.
Yeah,
I'll never forget it.
Maybe so. Melissa, thank you. And you're not putting us on here. You saw this.
I promise on the Bible. And she wasn't faking because, I don't know, she just didn't seem, she was dressed as an elderly village, Greek village woman. I don't know if she would be faking it, but I'm not, but oh my gosh, did we all just look at each other pie-eyed and just...
I bet you did. Melissa, thank you. There's a first-hand account. Brian, does this fit a formula, or is each one different?
Well, there are certainly different formulae that the church has used. In fact, actually, the Roman ritual, the one that was published in 1614 to try to standardize the exorcism ritual, was in effect until 1999.
Well, we'll come to the exorcism, but what about the woman's behavior itself? Does it fit a pattern, I should say, what you heard?
The thing is, maybe I should just go back and just say what I'm trying to do in the book and how this fits in with it, because the explanation that this bizarre behavior could be attributed to the devil or to multiple demons was never fully accepted. I mean, most people in the 16th and 17th century believed in that, but it was never fully accepted by even contemporaries who said that, well, actually, these people aren't really possessed by the devil. And this is where science comes in. This is where medical science comes in. They says they were suffering from some kind of disease. It was epilepsy or it was melancholy. Or in the 19th century, they kept emphasizing that it was hysteria. And in more recent times, they say it was multiple personality syndrome. In other words, all these different explanations come forward. And my book is an attempt to make sense of this this phenomenon. And what I have found is that those rational medical psychiatric explanations cannot possibly explain all of the symptoms. And what I argue in the book is that all possessions were sacred dramas. They were performances. And the demoniacs and the exorcists who were trying to dispossess them, to drive out the devils, were following scripts that were encoded in their religious cultures, and these scripts were widely known. You have some of them in the Bible, but you also had all these accounts of other possessions that people read at this time. And once it was suggested that they might be demonically possessed, you know, they had fits or something like that, then they would actually follow that script. Sometimes they got the scripts from sermons that were being given in which they talked about other cases of possession.
But are you suggesting when you say sacred drama that anxiety, the hysteria wasn't real, that it was just a show?
You're not saying that, are you? Oh, no. I'm saying that, yes, certainly the anxiety was real, and they are responding to it. And especially some of the early symptoms actually did reflect maybe guilt or anxiety or what have you, perhaps sexual anxiety. But what happens is that once the possession proceeds, then they begin to act the way demoniacs were expected to act. So they're all and they're not deliberately doing this. Some of them are. Some of them are actually faking their possessions in order to accuse witches, for example, of having caused their possession. But most of them aren't. They are just this is so much in their religious culture that they start performing the way demoniacs were expected to perform. And in the modern period, getting back to the incident of our call, obviously that woman was aware of the way that demoniacs acted in her particular society.
It's in the culture.
Yeah, that's right. And also the priest who is exercising it, he's following a script too, because he's aware of exorcism. He believes that, in fact, these are demons, and therefore he is saying prayers. He might be following the official Vatican prescription, so to speak.
And there is one, and as you said, updated not so long ago. Gypsy.
Yeah, 1999. Yeah. I mean, they had this other one. There were all sorts of informal, unapproved demonic exorcisms of demoniacs during the early modern period. And in 1614, the papacy said, we really have to have one. And that was the one that was the official one right until 1999. And they revised the entire Roman ritual after Vatican II. And the last ritual that they revised was this one in 1999. That's the one he should have been using.
But it definitely
is out there. And certainly the exorcists, especially in Italy and Latin America, are using that particular manual. It's a manual.
I want to learn more, but hold the thought for a moment. Gypsy's calling from Boston. Gypsy, you're on with Brian Levack.
Hi, Tom. My question really centers around whether or not either of you believe it to be true. Not that the demoniacs, as you said, believe it to be true themselves in their performativity. That much is clear. But do you believe demonic possession is, in fact, something that can occur, or do you believe it is all a mental illness or, as you said, a performance?
Brian?
I do not myself believe in the reality of demonic possession. I am a skeptic. I don't believe that the devil – I don't really believe in the devil. I don't believe that the devil can possess people. But as an historian, I'm really trying to explain this particular behavior. I cannot – as an historian, I cannot argue that the devil was doing this. You might believe that. But historians are not supposed to present supernatural explanations of natural phenomena because there's no evidence for it. I mean, there's no way that we can prove it. So what we have to deal with are the particular cases. And what I'm trying to do is to show that the medical explanations are insufficient, that the one explanation that actually encompasses all of these possessions then and now is the performative argument that I am presenting now.
And medical explanation, people are responding on that front because, I mean, you still have very much out there the idea that these were expressions of mental illness. Here a listener writes online, says the real story is not about exorcism, but about the credulousness and cruelty that served as an excuse to torture the mentally ill for centuries. I guess you're kind of taking issue with that, Brian.
Well, I would certainly argue that – I would argue against the idea that it all can be reduced to mental illness. And the reason I argue that is that the symptoms that we have been talking about, the psychological symptoms, the verbal symptoms, the speaking in these deep voices, the speaking of languages, but especially the blasphemy, the contempt for social, the contempt for sacred objects, throwing the Bible across the room if you're a Protestant, or spitting on a crucifix if you're a Catholic. Those things cannot be accommodated within an explanation that is based on hysteria or any kind of mental illness. So that is why I have saying we have to go beyond this. I mean, mental illness may – a personality disorder certainly could play a part in this. I'm not denying that. But it can't provide a comprehensive explanation.
People are asking why they would do it though. I mean, you describe – and we'll get to this – but you describe some of these exorcisms were brutal. I mean, they in the name of going after the devil, it could be very, very physically hard on the – demonically possessed one. Ed writes and asks, why would people act possessed if it could get them killed? I guess that would be extreme, but they could sure get a thrashing here.
Well, they would act possessed because they were trying to explain what was going on inside them. They were responding to guilt, perhaps, anxiety. They didn't expect that they would be treated violently when they were exorcised. Once they displayed the signs of demonic possession,
they didn't. But you say they kind of knew the theater.
But that came when the exorcist entered into the picture. And, of course, the reason you get violence in these exorcisms is that the exorcist believed that he was not really dealing with the person, the demoniac. He was dealing with the devil who had taken over this person. So you get these terrible stories of priests beating the demoniac of the victim. Actually, in a modern case, I don't know if you saw the picture of the exorcism of Emily Rose, which is based on the exorcism of a woman in Germany in 1973, and their exorcism resulted in her death. There are all sorts of exorcisms today that are violent, and they cause death. They cause a terrible physical harm. So, in other words, there is a dimension to exorcism that involves violence, and of course, it's also violence against women, especially younger women. And
were they historically most often the demoniac, as you say?
Yeah, they were. I mean, about probably 75 to 80% of them were women. Most of them were young women. Many of the cases of possession in the 16th and 17th century were group possessions that took place in convents, in which one person began to display the symptoms of demonic possession.
You know, like then, 30 at a time.
And then, sometimes you get 20 or 30 of them. The most famous case is the Devils of Loudun in France in the 1630s. And that was, again, another film. We've had a number of films about that. But Ken Russell's The Devils.
Yeah. Of course, it was not only in Catholic circles. It was also in Protestant circles.
It was, yes. And of course, one of the things I try to argue in the book is that the scripts that are being followed, both by the demoniacs and by the exorcists, are very different in Protestant and in Catholic culture. For example, there is the rejection of objects that were sacred in Catholicism because the devil is making you do that. So you're spitting on the crucifix and trampling on the Eucharist and blaspheming in Catholic culture. But then in Protestant culture, where they don't have the same belief in the sacraments and in sacramentals, there the Bible is the basis of belief and of their religion. So the Protestant demoniacs are taking Bibles and throwing them across the room or trampling on them or going into fits whenever they hear the Bible actually being read
Brian
to Lack, them.
Hold the thought right there. Father Jeffries is calling from Southington, Connecticut. Father Jeffries, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. Father as in Catholic priest, sir?
That's right. That's right. The last 40 years.
What's your observation on all this?
Well, my observation is that when there is a request for an exorcism on the part of a priest, he has to have the permission, first of all, of the bishop, and they do a thorough psychological examination of the person, history and so forth, in order to determine whether there is any mental illness of any kind present. And then there is indeed a ritual that's gone through after it's been determined that there isn't a mental illness. And I have witnessed one of them, and although what the author says is that there was some violence and so forth in terms of the person's acting out, I experienced a person's physical reaction when the Eucharist was passed over a place where she said she had pain and so forth. Now, it was we were behind her. We were not touching her or anything of that sort.
And Father, for non-Catholics or non-Christians, when you say the Eucharist, do you mean here the communion wafer being passed over?
I mean the Blessed Sacrament, the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus.
Yes. Okay.
And I know a number of priests who are involved in this kind of ministry, and although the author doesn't is a skeptic. I'm not a skeptic. I've seen it with myself. I've seen people, at least in this particular case, and know others who have. And I also realize that talking with police departments and so forth, there is an increase of satanic worship, especially in Connecticut. Many times where there's been a crime scene, there's obvious evidence of worship of evil spirits, if not Satan himself. So,
but Father Jeffries, do you think that it's actually a spirit, the devil in there, and this tosses the devil out, or this is a person who's just in a bad way, and the ritual calms them?
No, I believe that it is possible, and it does happen at times that the evil one, the Satan or one of his minions, does indeed either possesses the person in at some level. Either severely influences the person or is actually, because they've been put through a satanic rite, has taken up residence in the person's body.
Father Jeffries, calling from Southern Connecticut, I'm glad you called. We can see that this is something you've witnessed, and you have a direct relationship with it as a representative of the faith. We're going to look at the history here with Brian Levesque. Thank you for your call. Brian, please stand by in Austin, Texas. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We're talking this hour about the long and revealing story of exorcism, possession, and exorcism, the origins, the history, method, madness. My guest is Brian Levack, history professor at the University of Texas, Austin. His new book is The Devil Within, Possession and Exorcism in the Christian West. It's a deep, scholarly book. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It just keeps coming. 2011 film The Rite, young seminarian Michael Kovac, played by Colin O'Donoghue, travels to Italy and takes an exorcism course. He has to overcome a great deal of skepticism. Here from the trailer.
It's not the devil. Just a very, very sick girl. She doesn't need a priest. She needs a shrink.
It's not the devil. It's just a very, very sick girl. Tracy in Lexington, Massachusetts. Tracy, you're on with Brian Levack.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a nurse, and I'm fascinated with the behavioral manifestations of brain illnesses, and I wonder if the author is aware of any systematic studies that have been done to rule out physical or medical causes. I mean, we know as far back as prehistoric times that things like syphilis and even Lyme disease was found in a frozen man. And mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if, you know, maybe some of these manifestations really have a physical cause rather than mental illness.
Tracy, Nurse Tracy, I appreciate that. Brian, what makes you so sure that it's a ritual reenactment rather than a manifestation of, you know, some physical pathology, illness, or mental?
I mean, I certainly accept the fact that some kind of psychiatric problem, some kind of personality disorder, perhaps some kind of physical illness, such as epilepsy, or even what is now called dissociative identity disorder, mm-hmm. which used to be called multiple personality syndrome, could play a part in this. My argument is that those physical or medical or psychiatric explanations cannot provide a complete convincing explanation of what is actually happening, what's going on. Then, in other words, I see all of this as part of this sacred drama, but I'm not discounting the fact that there could be all sorts of social or psychological or medical origins, especially of the early symptoms of possession, the convulsions, the fits, that type of thing. So, but in the past, I mean, you go all the way back to ancient times. Hippocrates argued that they were all epileptics. Throughout the Middle Ages, it was a belief that they were epileptics. Then they argued that it was melancholy, which is some form of depression. And then the explanation took over that it was hysteria. That actually worked to some extent because of the women who were demoniacs, but we also had the problem of male demoniacs, and hysteria was supposed to be something that was characteristic only of female ones. And of course, Freud gets his start working with Jean-Martin Charcot in France at studying male demoniacs. And, of course, he ends up talking about it not being hysteria, but being some other form of schizophrenia, basically. That was the argument.
Freud's answer.
The thing is that I'm not excluding these other possibilities. I'm just showing that they're insufficient. And as an historian, I'm trying to figure out what actually happened.
Janet in Auburn, Alabama. Janet, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Incredibly interesting topic. Had an experience some 40 years ago with an exorcism. I'm a believer, a Christian. We were working at a Salvation Army camp. A girl was very resistant to the love of God, we felt, just incredibly more than usual, and the counselors felt we should pray for her one night because of her belligerence and her anger. And we're sitting out on the porch of a cabin and praying hard, and all of a sudden this ugly bug came walking across the road of the floor of the porch, and we stomped on it and felt this huge release of power. And the girl was markedly different and receptive the next day. I believe this. I think, as C.S. Lewis said in Screwtape Letters, one of the first steps that the devil can have over a human being is to have you not believe in him. And then the other extreme of thinking everything is caused by some kind of demonic action is also false. But that if we deny that this spiritual peace exists, then we're missing the wholeness of it. I'm hoping that perhaps the brain mapping that we're going into well, as your guest has said, this cannot be explained by chemistry.
Well,
that there is something else there besides just chemical reactions.
Though, who knows? I mean, there's a lot of mapping yet to be done. Who knows what more we'll learn? But it's interesting the way, Janet, you say you're a religious believer, but you're still open to putting this in some kind of middle ground. You're not the only one on that front, Janet. We've got a listener online saying, I think it's about the amount of mental wisdom that is just out of reach of the conscious mind. It's interesting, Brian. People are open. You're saying ritual reenactment. Others are open to, some sort of dynamics here that they may not put in terms of the devil, but they may put in terms of what interactions that we don't fully understand.
Yeah, I get. Could I just go back to ask Janet whether or not she is a Protestant or a Catholic?
I'm sorry to say she's gone.
Okay. Because it's very interesting. Because and this really is important in terms of the different scripts. Because Catholics have this ritual of exorcism. Protestants reject that the exorcism as something that is magical and superstitious. They believe, based on biblical accounts of exorcism, the only thing you can do is to pray and to fast. And it sounds as if that was a Protestant exorism.
But they kind of meld. I mean,
and wait for God to remove.
But a Pentecostal prayer can be a pretty vigorous activity. No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not putting Pentecostals in either the Catholic or the Protestant camp. I mean, and they certainly are responsible for or engage in a large number of the possessions today.
What about Jewish possessions? You write about them also increasing in number at the same time that they did among Catholics and Protestants in the 16th, 17th century. What was that about?
Well, I mean, they are very different from Catholic possessions because or from Protestant ones as well, because the belief of Jews in possession was based on the belief that the souls of the dead came back and inhabited the person. And both Protestants and Catholics, the Dybbuk's, right. And, and there was a very famous play by S. Anski in the early 20th century. I think it was called Dybbuk, about that. So,
the Kabbalistic doctrine of transmigration of souls.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's based on that idea, and that comes from Kabbalistic scholarship in the 12th century that believed in this. So, but Catholics and Christians basically rejected this. So you have the phenomenon of Jewish possession, and it's really. There are a number of cases in the 16th and 17th century, and they can be attributed to the same social and religious forces that I've identified. It's just that the script – here we go again. The Jewish script is different from the Protestant script and the Catholic script.
Let's go to Jeff in Oklahoma City. Jeff, thanks for calling from Oklahoma.
Hey. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in. I was witness to – my cousin, who I've been close with most of my life, he had an exorcism about age 16 or 17.
Catholic or Protestant? What kind of setting was it in, Jeff?
Protestant, quasi-Pentecostal. I mean, it wasn't really any denomination, but it was Protestant.
Yep.
And, I mean, he displayed a lot of the things that you would associate with an exorcism. But I think, in his mind, he really believed he was possessed, and I think the mind's a powerful thing. We know about the placebo effect and people willing themselves to be sick. So I was wondering what you thought about he was possessed, but purely because he believed he was, and I think his body manifested the possession on what his what reconciled with the way his mind thought a possession should be.
Jeff, you're seem like a wise observer there. Brian, how do you respond to that duly question in the description there?
I think that a lot of these people did very much believe that they were possessed, and indeed it was on the basis of that belief, which was suggested to them by very often by clerics, by ministers, pastors, also by members of their family, on the basis of that, they would begin to act the way that demoniacs acted. And of course, once you had a ritual that tried to remove the devil, tried to drive the devil out, that can be a considerable solace. And indeed, the earlier caller talked about that. And that one of the reasons why the exorcisms worked was the belief that indeed something was being done about it. It also explains why in the early modern period, in the 16th and 17th centuries, mm-hmm. The Catholic exorcisms generally were more effective than the Protestant ones, because
why?
The Protestants couldn't do very much. They had to sit and simply pray and fast and hope that God would
intervene.
They
didn't have all the ritual and regalia.
They didn't have the ritual, which, exactly.
Better theater.
And the Protestants are really concerned about this, because they say, look, the Catholics are so much better at exercising. We're not succeeding, but the Catholics are. And I think the explanation lies in the psychology of those people who were demonically possessed.
I mean, you describe audiences of 25 and 30,000 people watching these things. So to think of the theatricality element, you cannot ignore it. Diane in Nashville, Tennessee. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My grandfather was an Italian born in Brazil. When mm-hmm. he was traveling in Italy in the 1920s, he was called up to a remote mountain village. There was a young girl in a convulsing. The villagers had no idea what she was saying. She was speaking in a male voice. And my grandfather, who was a multilingual, was able to realize that she was speaking in Portuguese. No one in the village knew Portuguese or had known someone who spoke Portuguese. And she was telling the story of being a sailor who had died a violent death. We, are, as a family, are non-religious. Mm-hmm. We are secular. We are science-based. We are evidence-based. And we've never understood how to think about this story from my grandfather, who also was a very learned person who was very science-based.
Well, why put it in a religious context at all? Why not? I mean, as Jeff said in Oklahoma, the mind is a powerful thing. Is it not, Diane?
Make up a language to understand. This is a young girl speaking a language that no one in the village knew.
Yeah, well, that's a stretch. These stories just keep coming. Diane, I appreciate that. I mean, Brian, if I may just share, it's you know, they're all over the place. Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, there's this account he wrote for the New Oxford Review back in 1994 called Beating a Demon, Physical Dimensions of Spiritual Warfare. Mm-hmm. And Bobby Jindal writing about how he had been, as a young man, this, I guess, friend of his, a charismatic Christian, Susan, had been diagnosed with cancer and had trouble in her social circle. And she started, having visions and smelling like sulfur. And Jindal was there when she, he writes, suddenly she was emitting strange guttural sounds and fell to the floor and started thrashing about as if in a seizure. She turned to him, the now governor of Louisiana, and said, Bobby, you cannot even love Susan, in this deep voice, whether it's in the hills of Italy or right there in our own country. Reverend Delgado calling from New York City. Reverend Delgado, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What's your experience?
Great dialogue you're having. Well, I'm a Pentecostal minister over 20 years, and I've experienced exorcisms here in New York and also in Central America. The last one was 5 years ago in the Republic of Honduras, where I was doing crusade. Young lady was brought up, and I also really like what the author was saying. I don't believe that there should be such a stretch between science and religion, but without a doubt, medical science can't explain some of the things that I've witnessed. So I can keep an open mind. I'm very learned. I'm a doctor, but without a doubt, medical science cannot explain the reality of the spiritual manifestation.
But who says it's not scientifically explainable, Reverend Delgado? If someone's in the midst of some great trauma and you offer them the theater or the therapy of a ritual that helps them, why couldn't that be a psychological cure?
Well, you're talking about situations like psychosomatic illnesses, which a lot of manifestations could be made based on the power of the mind. But there are spiritual conditions that, there's no way the mind can reproduce. It definitely is beyond the natural, and that's where you come into the supernatural. It's beyond the natural, expression. Well, and I want to also say that one thing I like to differentiate for the audience here, that there's a big difference between possession and oppression. Possession is a total extreme case. where truly, as the author said, the person has totally lost all personal will. They're totally controlled by demonic forces, you know. So in a case like that, there's no way a person could be acting or just wanting to manifest for sake of a, you know, psychological exercise.
We've got your witness there, a little Pentecostal witness from Reverend Delgado. Brian Levesque, people will interpret this in many ways, according to their faith, belief, scientific outlook, you name it. How do you end up looking at the periods that produce more of this? You talked about the social and cultural sort of backdrop to this. Why would it be in the 16th and 17th century, and maybe again at the end of the 20th, even in the early 21st? Why in these times?
I think that in both of these periods, and also we could even go back to the period of early Christianity, there was this concern with the end of the world, this apocalyptic thought. There was this growing fear of the devil, an awareness of the devil, at least apparently a belief in the devil, influencing the course of human events. And I think that that is the cultural setting for large number of possessions. Certainly, the theater, the entertainment industry, is responsible for raising the awareness of the of the devil's activity in the world. But I don't think you can attribute it all to The Exorcist or the exorcism of Emily Rose or the devil's any of that.
But ritual reenactment, yeah, you say. I mean, the hot word these days is meme. Almost a repeated meme here of the exorcism and possession.
Yeah, they certainly are going to increase the belief in the devil, and that is going to lead to the belief that the devil can actually do these things.
Times of change and times of challenge. Brian Levesque, it's been really interesting, a realm we had not set foot in before, but you've taken us there, and with a lot of insight and academic deep consideration. We're grateful for it. The book is The Devil Within, Possession and Exorcism in the Christian West. Professor Levesque joined us from the University of Texas at Austin, professor of history there. Brian Levesque, thank you very much for your work and for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, tomorrow we're looking at the role in society of the teenage star, from Annette Funicello to Justin Bieber. What role they play? Join us then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.